Welcome to ESUMP's Global Economy Podcast. I am Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Inu Manak. Inu is a scholar of international political economy at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and at the Georgetown University's Department of Government. She specializes, among other things, in trade and development, and has recently written a paper with James Backus on special and differential treatment in trade agreements, which means that developing countries don't take on the same obligations in World Trade Organization agreements as developed countries. This is also the topic for today's conversation.
Inu, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start by reading you a tweet from Donald Trump, where he talks about the World Trade Organization and, in particular, the status of developing countries in the WTO and their rules. Trump is saying, "The WTO is broken when the world's richest countries claim to be developing countries to avoid WTO rules and get special treatment. No more. Today, I directed the U.S. trade representatives to take action so that countries stop cheating the system at the expense of the USA," close quote. So this is Donald Trump talking about what we trade nerds call special and differential treatment, which means that some countries just declare themselves to be developing countries, and as a consequence of that, they don't need to take on the same obligations that developed countries have in the system. So just because Trump is saying this, does it mean that, as usual, that he gets things totally wrong and that we shouldn't pay any attention at all to the system of special and differential treatment in the WTO?
Well, I would say in this instance, Trump actually has this somewhat right. I would say the way that he's delivered the criticism probably isn't the best way to talk about this issue. But at the same time, he does have a point. And the fact is that the world has fundamentally changed since the WTO was founded, since the GATT was written, and our rules have not really kept up with that change. And the biggest problem that we have is that we have countries that at one point were quite small economic partners are now playing a much more outsized, influential role in the global trading system. But they don't take on the obligations that match that level of growth that they've had. So I think he's right to point out that there is a fundamental divide between countries, and there's differentiation between developing countries that we actually have to take a hard look at.
So what countries are we talking about here? Is it a China problem, or is it another form of problem?
Well, I would say China is probably the country that stands out the most. I mean, in fact, if you look at the U.S. proposal that came out, China is mentioned more than any other country in that proposal, about 51 times. But at the same time, there's a lot of other countries that fit the bill. So, for example, South Korea has historically been considered a developing country. But when you think of a place like South Korea, you don't really associate it with a developing country status. And that's part of the issue that he raises. In addition, there's Japan as well, which has also had developing country status in the past. Singapore, which is also a booming economy, also considers itself a developing country. And Brazil as well. So I think that what he's pointing to are greater differentiation that does exist in the developing world, what we've considered traditionally to be the developing world, which is not just about China, though China certainly is the clearest example of what this is.
So let's come back to China in a minute, but let us first talk a little bit about what does it mean to get special and differential treatment? Does it mean that you can have tariffs that are higher than perhaps in countries that are developed countries? Does it mean that you can escape some of the rules that countries have agreed to in the WTO?
Right. So there's a variation of different provisions that special and differential treatment encapsulates. A lot of it requires or gives countries longer time periods for implementing the agreements and their commitments. So these are like phase outs for tariffs, which happens quite often, did happen quite often in the past. But there's also measures to increase trading opportunities for developing countries. This covers the generalized system of preferences. There are provisions that require WTO members to safeguard the trade interests of developing countries. And there's also support to help developing countries build the capacity to carry out their WTO work, to handle disputes and implement technical standards. And then there's a separate set of provisions related to least developed countries, which are a separate special category of developing country members. But overall, what we've seen with the use of the S&D has been carve-outs, exceptions, and longer time periods to phase out these tariffs. And this is been one of the biggest issues that have been raised among the developed countries that they find unfair.
So is it just America among the group of, say, leading developed economies that have been irritated by this system of SDT, which have enabled countries like Singapore, South Korea, countries that by every standard are now developed economies? Have other countries reacted to this as well?
Definitely. And this is one of the areas where I think we have a lot of broad agreement that there is a problem that needs to be solved. In fact, we've had Norway submit a concept paper on this issue. Canada also submitted a paper on this issue to WTO. And the European Union has also weighed in. And in fact, a lot of the points that the European Union has raised are very similar to the issues that the Trump administration has raised in its paper. So I think that there's a lot of room for compromise, and there's a lot of room for finding a way forward where all parties can actually find a system that works for everyone. But honestly, this is something that there is a lot of buy-in that there is an issue that we need to address, and not just among the developed world. In fact, a lot of developing countries as well have said that the current system doesn't work, that SDT hasn't really given them the benefits that they thought they were going to get from these provisions and these carve-outs. And they have also called for more differentiation as well. So it's not just the developed world bullying or pushing the developing countries around. This is really a broad issue among the entire membership in which I think we can move forward.
So what do you make of the argument, which I've heard from some people, which is that, you know, even if countries that have had developing country designation in the WTO, even if they can accept sort of in the abstract that they are now developed and should be able to take on obligations and responsibilities of a kind which are similar to what developed economies have, they still want to keep it because this is a pretty good negotiation card with other countries if you want to, for instance, negotiate a bilateral free trade agreement with them. So if they were going to change their designation in the WTO, it may mean that they don't have so much to negotiate with if, for instance, they want to do an FTA with America, the EU, or perhaps other developed economies in the world.
Right. I would say that argument doesn't really stand up to the actual evidence of what we've seen in negotiations. I mean, look at the Doha round, which is still incomplete. Part of the reason for that has been the stalling of a lot of countries to say that we require these extra exceptions, or they're not willing to trade off certain concessions because of developing country status. And this has been a huge problem here. So I think that largely when we look at using this as a negotiating chip, it mostly frustrates negotiations than moves them forward. And in fact, we've seen this historically in multilateral trade negotiations as well, where we've seen developed countries not give in certain issue areas such as agriculture, textiles, which are areas where developing countries actually have a comparative advantage. And one of the reasons they didn't do that is because of special and differential treatment, where these countries were carving out other areas and saying, we're not going to liberalize here. So with the failure of reciprocity, I think what you end up having is a system in which you have a lot of unfairness that gets baked in because everyone's not willing to commit to the highest standards of liberalization.
And to follow on that point that you're just making now, Inu, what do you say about the argument, even if it's not as specific as the T issue, but there's been an argument out there regarding the Doha round and the failures of members to conclude an agreement, which have largely suggested that, well, the problem perhaps wasn't so much between developing countries and developed countries. It was rather within developing country group itself, where some countries feared that if a large economy and a large competitive economy like China is not going to take on any new obligations, or if they're going to have obligations which are similar to what you would have if you are a developing economy, that's going to give them a relation to other developing countries, which is going to make it very difficult for others to compete with the Chinese.
Certainly, and I think that the divide within the developing country bloc was very apparent in the failure of Doha, and we see that. So think of it, if you're a developing country that actually is struggling to integrate into the world trading system, and you see a player like China that has a lot more resources at its disposal and the capacity to do a lot more than you can, well, you're not going to want to sign up to the same level of obligation as China, but at the same time, you're also going to feel pretty spurned that China gets all these other carve-outs too. So I think that what that creates is this air of greater unfairness, and that's a big problem that I think is exactly at the heart of what the issue is at Doha and what the issue is more broadly in these negotiations that we're even seeing in terms of fishery subsidies, where you know you have a system in which some of the countries that subsidize the most are asked to be treated as if that they cannot possibly get rid of those subsidies. So this is a huge, huge problem that I think has made it much more difficult for developing countries to fully integrate and take on the obligations that they actually can. It's just because they're holding on to the few things that they have in a way to try to get a little bit more leverage, but they're really not getting anywhere by doing that.
The issue of unfairness is also pretty strong now if you look at, for instance, the growing trade tensions between America and China. I mean, we in Europe basically have, at least in the substance, the same observations about unfairness in market access between China and us. And it seems to have been sort of, it's a recurring theme that comes up pretty often, regardless which type of country combination that we're talking about. I mean, I was giving you the quote from Donald Trump when we started, and of course he used colorful terms for it, calling it cheating. And that's not the issue here, because it's not that someone is cheating, but it is the fact that countries have different obligations. What I'm wondering here is, how do we address this issue more broadly about trade unfairness or perceived trade unfairness? Is it an issue that we should talk about? And I'm talking now outside sort of the concept of SDT, more about bilateral relations in the world economy. Is it something we should be concerned about, or is it something that we should just neglect because these are just the consequences of forces of competition?
Well, I think perhaps the way we should be talking about it, and it is broader than just the concept of SDT, but it's baked into the way that we think about negotiations. When we think about how negotiations have evolved over time and how we think about concessions, you know, that there's this fallacy that has emerged that is opening one's market involves concessions that need to be somehow paid for, that tariffs and other barriers to trade are national assets that should be relinquished only in exchange for improved market access abroad. But this doesn't really make any sense when you think about it, because a country benefits from reducing its own barriers to trade with other countries, regardless of what other countries do, you know? And so this has been one of the issues, I think, that needs to be talked about a little bit more. And the problem has been, even within the way that we think about the relationship between developed and developing countries, we have this baked-in notion that non-reciprocity is the norm. And this comes from a long history of negotiations in the 60s and 70s that basically embedded this idea that developed countries don't have to essentially expect the same level of reciprocity from others. Now, what that creates is an unfair system when you think about it. When you have one set of countries that has to liberalize more and another set that essentially doesn't have to take on those obligations. And that gets kind of transferred over to lots of other negotiating areas, not just the WTO. So in that sense, it is a bigger issue and a bigger problem. And if we all thought more about the fact that when we're doing these, you know, big negotiations at the WTO or elsewhere and trade, what we ought to think about is what is of the greatest benefit to improving the economic outcomes of all players involved. And that answer is never going to be more protectionism. So if we think about it that way, we can actually improve the outcomes that we kind of set out to try to achieve to begin with in terms of improving development outcomes, improving growth, which we really have not successfully achieved through this idea of non-reciprocity.
So let's take a step back and look at the history of SDT. When did the concept SDT enter the world of trade negotiators? When did we first have an agreement that encapsulated special and differential treatment?
Well, the negotiating history is a little long, but it started really in the post-war era. When we're looking at 1955, the GATT contracting parties adopted a revision of certain articles that basically gave authorization to developing countries to enact measures to protect infant industries. And this was going to afford them additional ease in imposing trade restrictions when facing balance of payments difficulties as well. Now, that's when the idea of sort of non-reciprocity formally gets introduced into the legal text of the GATT. And after that, it sort of builds a little bit more. And we see this emerge in the 60s and 70s, particularly with the enabling clause, which solidifies this idea of non-reciprocity that basically ends up saying that, you know, there are some stage in which developing countries essentially cannot meet all these commitments, and therefore they're going to be given special tariff preferences. So that's where we have the rise of GSP, Generalized System of Preferences, which basically allows for just trade discrimination, forbidding trade discrimination between like imported products from developing countries. So we see this change emerge, but at that same time that that emerges, you also see a backlash towards it. And it's in the 1970s that I think that you see the United States actually first begin to express the view that we see today, that differential treatment is some sort of problem, and that we should have some form of graduation for developing countries out of SDT. And that's sort of where that conversation emerged. But we've sort of been stuck since the 70s in this same back and forth tussle about what graduation means, considering the fact that the WTO has never yet defined what it even means to be a developing country.
And was it entirely from the beginning and during the first decades that you talked about, was it entirely a tariff issue? So it never really stretched into any other issue than tariffs?
Well, it was a little bit in other areas. So I think in the original sort of formulation of SDT, a lot of it was about policy space for developing countries to adjust. And that encapsulated things like infant industry protection. It gave them a little bit more space to deal with balance of payments issues. So things that they were concerned about in the post-war years as they were integrating into the global marketplace. But it kind of evolved over time to be more about tariffs, and almost solely about tariffs, and then about carve outs for certain areas. But when you look at the actual text and what we actually agreed to, a lot of what you see are sort of best endeavor clauses. Basically, these are things that are committing developed countries to give more preferential treatment to developing countries when they're considering trade negotiations. The problem is that basically you have these, you know, best endeavor clauses, but none of them are binding obligations. And so what we found over time was that when we got down to the Uruguay round, that this idea of non-reciprocity sort of was moved away from. And what we ended up having was a growing resentment from the developing world that they were actually asked to take on a lot more commitments than they thought they would have. But you look at the text of that agreement, there's still 183 SDT provisions, which are still embedded in the WTO agreements, even though the Uruguay round was a pivotal change. And moving away from different levels of obligations, which were embedded in the previous agreements, to a focus on the need to adjust more broadly to WTO rules. But we're still left with a mishmash of very different provisions, and it's really hard to get a handle on how this is actually sort of played out with each individual country over time.
And why do you think that countries didn't make more of an effort in order to sort these things out during the Uruguay round?
That's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of the reason this was not really dealt with was because it didn't really have the framework for thinking about how to move away from this. I think that at the point at which we got to Uruguay, we were stuck in this way of thinking that non-reciprocity was something we had to live with, that SDT had become this treaty-embedded right that became something we couldn't touch. And because it became treated like that, we kind of lost the ability to really negotiate about SDT. And instead, what we had was sort of a band-aid that we put on it that said, okay, all we need is adjustment now. We need to focus on just adjusting to the rules instead of thinking about more broadly whether these provisions and this way of thinking about trade negotiations even makes sense or even gives the real benefits to the countries that are involved within these agreements.
What do you make of the argument that, I mean, and of course this is something that in the abstract at least could have been corrected later, but at least during the 1990s, in the second half of the 1990s and the early part of the noughties, when we were discussing the firstly the Millennium Round and later the Doha Round, a lot of developing countries at that point that were saying that, no, you can complain in developed economies about the special and preferential treatments we have, but at least some of it actually comes from the fact that we believe that trade negotiations in the past and trade agreements in the past have been unbalanced in the favor of developed economies, because they typically dealt with issues like tariffs on industrial goods and merchandises, at the same time as countries like the USA and Europe, they maintain pretty high barriers on textiles, cotton, agriculture products, food, which were typically the type of goods that developing countries could export. So they wanted to claim sort of the right to have a negotiating round that was going to deal specifically with their concerns. And they would say that there was an inbuilt agenda from the Uruguay round that pointed everyone to a new round that was going to be more developing friendly and deal with his historical injustices from the past. What do you make of that argument?
Right. I think that really refers to this idea that has been put forward by China and a number of others, that the developed world has engaged in what they term reverse SDT, where the developed countries have essentially carved out sensitive sectors of their own that have been shielded from competition, where the developing countries actually have a comparative advantage. Now, I would say that the issue is not really the fact that, you know, there was this imbalance in negotiation from the get-go. It was the fact that developing countries asked for there to be an imbalance in negotiations. And that's what created sort of this, I think, backlash against what was happening in the 60s and 70s, when we had sort of the acceptance of non-reciprocity as a tool. Now, the problem that we were left with was that at that same time where non-reciprocity became enshrined within the GATT is exactly when you have countries, as you said, you know, protecting cotton, textiles, and agriculture. Now, I would say the solution is not thinking more about what can developing countries get, but thinking about how can we all liberalize a little bit more so that even the developed world opens up these highly protected markets. Because I think a lot of the reason that these markets remain very protected in the developed world was simply because even the developed world thought it was unfair. And they use the unfairness argument. Why should we open up these sensitive sectors to competition when the other side of the world, which makes up a big portion of global trade, is also not opening up equally? So I think that's what causes part of the problem. So if we can disband a little bit more of this non-reciprocity, I think that's actually what would get us to complete something like the Doha Round or other agreements. And that's really what stalled it.
So the Doha Round never finished, and we didn't really have any systemic improvement in the existing agreements, well, ever since the millennium or ever since the 1990s. The one big thing that happened in the WHO context in the noughties was, of course, China's accession to the World Trade Organization. What do you think were the significance of China's accession in this particular context? We had an accession protocol for China, which were perhaps not so much dealing with issues that were of concern to other developing. We had a few issues, especially regarding the market economy status and that debate, which were a way to try to respond to concerns that existed in the United States and in Europe about 15 years after accession, that China may not be ready to get full rights in terms of market access to other countries because their economic system were at least thought to be or to remain vastly different from the economics in the capitalist part of the world. But what do you think, what was the significance of China's accession and the protocol that we negotiated then for the issue of special and differential treatment?
Right, so I think China in particular is an interesting case only because the accession protocol that China signed was pretty liberalizing when you think about it, considering the concerns that other people have raised in the past about China's protectionism. Now, I would say that what China agreed to was actually a lot more forward thinking than some would give them credit for. Henry Gao, who's an expert in the WTO law and Asian and comparative legal systems, has observed that, you know, China did not avail itself of full developing country treatment in those protocols. For instance, China agreed to an 8.5% de minimis level for its agricultural support, which is below the 10% that other developing countries received in the agreement on agriculture, for instance. So I think in that sense, China was aware at the outset, and everyone negotiating with China was aware how fast it was growing and what an important player it would be in the future of world trade. So I think that was well kept in mind at the point. But the fact is that it has grown quite quickly since then, even. And to think that, you know, China shouldn't take on more obligations as it has grown and become a much larger player in the system is not really how we're going to sort of square the circle on this issue. Other developing countries have noticed, and they've pointed out also that they simply cannot compete with China in this way, and that China should take on greater obligations. So I think that, you know, this certainly was something that was at the top of the minds of negotiators when China did join the WTO. And it's certainly something that is still kept in mind in current negotiations that are ongoing in e-commerce and also in fishery subsidies.
So let's look finally a little bit towards the future. So you, Inu, you've written a paper together with James Bokus proposing a way to address the problems that we have or the issues that we have with SDT. What is it that you're proposing?
So first, we think that SDT has to be on the negotiating agenda. This is an issue that we cannot miss this opportunity to actually address. So when we're going into the ministerial next year, we should be thinking about this issue and actively talking about it. And it's good that we have actually been talking about it recently. And I think that hopefully this leads us to something in the form of a non-binding or illustrative guidelines that are agreed to by all WTO members in the form of some sort of ministerial declaration as a basis for evaluating future special and differential treatment claims. So what this means at the end of the day is what we want to do is to move away from this idea that you just get granted SDT just by the nature of being a developing country, but rather that SDT should be granted on a more case-by-case, product-by-product, sector-by-sector basis through a needs and evidence-based assessment of whether or not it's required. Now, this would need to be linked to the broader goal. If you want to achieve a development goal, well, then you also have to explain why certain carve-outs, exceptions, or any other special provision is actually going to help you achieve that. So I think that this is a much more data-driven way of thinking about SDT, but at the end of the day, it'll get us to a tighter sort of understanding of what it means, what outcomes it can actually produce, and make sure that only those countries that really require it get it. And right now, we're not at that point.
So that would mean sort of in practice that, let's say, a country like Kenya, it wants to have special differential treatment on agriculture goods. It would have to demonstrate in one way or the other that this is intended to spur local output in different regions that cannot compete with foreign produce coming in. And therefore, they need that special protection that a tariff will give them. Would that be the sort of the practical consequence of it?
Exactly. So what we're actually proposing is that the onus be placed more on the countries that want the treatment to explain why they need it and to really show how it actually improves their development outcomes. And this is really going to be a major shift in the way that SDT has been granted in the past. But at the end of the day, what it does is it actually empowers these countries to know a little bit more about how different obligations actually affect them and how they can benefit from liberalizing in certain sectors. So in this sense, you know, what we'd see for cases where you have, say, in fishery subsidies, countries that are the biggest subsidizers, well, should they actually get special and differential treatment if they can really afford to subsidize entire industries? Probably not. And so we need to think a little bit more about the capacity of countries to do certain things, and that needs to factor in too. And so at the end of the day, we also need an affirmative and binding obligation by all developed countries to provide the technical assistance to help with the capacity needs of countries that do need it, so that they can not only understand sort of the impact of certain provisions on their economies, but also help them meet other obligations in a timely way.
All right. Thanks very much, Inu, for a very good conversation, a very enlightening conversation. SDT is a technical concept that very few people know about, but I think you've explained it in a very, very good way to make the issue come alive. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.